She came in with all this hype, and she is a basketball player and a competitor and a winner who also gets attention, not a social media star who hoops on the side. She dove across the line in our first, workout session to make her time. And with someone that kind of talent, certainly it wouldn't be shocking if she cut a corner. She never cuts a corner.
That's USC women's basketball coach Lindsay Gottlieb talking about Juju Watkins. We interviewed her about Juju, Caitlin Clark, the growth of the women's game, and what stands in front of USC next season as they head to the Big Ten. Welcome to an all-new episode of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast.
What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner, a.k.a. John and John.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Big news this week. Tara Vanderveer, Stanford's longtime coach, the winningest coach in college basketball history, announced last night that she is retiring. And good fortune for us, our guest, Lindsay Gottlieb, USC's coach, will talk about Tara. She's going to talk about the state of the women's game. She's going to talk about Juju Watkins and going to the Big Ten and everything else, including some parenting advice for parents like John, who have three daughters.
Yeah, I am excited about that part. I want to ask her specifically because, she was raised and has turned into this coach, a person of influence who's influencing other people. And obviously there's a lot of confidence that comes with playing on that stage, coaching on that stage. And as a father of daughters, one of my primary jobs is to send my kids out into the world with confidence. So I'm curious to ask her kind of about, some parenting advice and what she got from her parents. And I think it's fantastic.
Yep. And she's, her resume as a coach is, as good as it gets. Final Four with Cal, coached in the NBA as an assistant on the Cavs staff. Now she's back at USC, took the Trojans to the Elite Eight this year in just her third season. And you have to figure they're going to be a power in the Big Ten and nationally as long as Gottlieb is there. So we should get right to it here.
I will cue her up here. Lindsay Gottlieb, head coach USC women's basketball. How you doing, coach?
I'm good. You booked me on this before you knew Tara was retiring, and now it just got even more exciting.
Yeah.
We would love to start with the news of the week and Tara Vanderveer's announced retirement, very low-key Vanderveer fashion. It was at like 7 o'clock on a Tuesday or something. Your reaction to Tara stepping down?
Yeah, I was driving my son to Disneyland. He was going to stay overnight with friends and go to Disneyland. So I'm about 5 minutes from Anaheim, and my husband's calling, and he's home with our little one. So I pick up going, is everything okay? Thinking, something wrong at home. And he said, everything's okay, but oh my gosh, Tara retired. So in our household, that's reason to call one another. It's big news. I would say my reaction ultimately is gratitude as I reflect on, what she's done for the game, particularly. And I know Tara doesn't want attention. That's probably why she retires at, 7:30 West Coast time, no year long, ceremonial kind of tour. But it's really cool for her to retire at the time when women's basketball kind of is at, the peak that it's ever been in terms of popularity and opportunities and where the game is, because people like Tara came in before any of that and spent their career building towards it. So I think that's neat. I've told the story before. I wrote letters to every Division I coach when I was a senior in college, and Tara wrote me a handwritten note back. That was 25 years ago. In that time, I've gotten to coach against her. I've had a front row seat to her consistency of excellence. I've seen her adapt her offense, with changing personnel and changing times. I mean, to say I've learned a ton from her without having worked for her, but it's an understatement. And so for me, just the gratitude I have for her raising the level of my own game, her raising the level for all of us, and having the opportunity to compete against her is something that I'll really cherish.
And you were, several seasons at Cal as an assistant coach before you were the head coach. Did you have interaction with her as far back as that in terms of at the coaching level?
Oh, totally. My first time ever standing up as a head coach was when I was an assistant at Cal, and our head coach Joanne Boyle had to go home for the death of her father. And it just happened to be, or when her father became ill and later passed away, but it happened to be Stanford week. So the first time I ever stood up and head coached a game was at Maples. And I remember Tara being really gracious then, you know, more so just picking her brain when I could, but really it was just the, you know, everyone comes in the Pac-12 and would play travel partners, right? So the film that we would always watch for our Sunday game was the Friday night game where they played Stanford. And so I would always say, okay, what was Stanford's game plan against, you know, insert Team X, UCLA, USC, Oregon, Oregon State. And so I always got to watch and see, well, this is what they were trying to do. This is what they did. Can we do that? Do we need to do something different? So you think about as being the blueprint of how I would kind of approach strategy often was more informed by them than you would think, because they were always the team that, you know, they played scouting report defense. So versus, you know, let's say someone like, you know, Arizona just pressures every game, you know, you're going to get pressure. Stanford kind of would tweak and do what you call scouting report defense. So you'd always know exactly what they were trying to do because their teams usually executed the scout. And then it's a matter of, did it work, or do we have the personnel to do the same thing, or do we need to do something different? So yeah, as an assistant, I learned a ton. I learned a ton just by observing.
I'm curious about the letter. What were you trying to accomplish in writing the letters, and what do you remember about what she wrote back?
I was trying to get a job. My senior year at Brown, I knew that I wanted to get into coaching, and you know, Ivy League kids tend to be, you know, a little bit type A, and you want to do things, you want to be proactive. So during winter break, my friends that were, you know, going to work at investment banks or consulting firms were having interviews. They were doing resumes, and I'm like, what do? I want to go into coaching. So I wrote a letter to 300 different coaches, you know, saying, this is who I am, this is what I want to do. And then a bunch of coaches wrote me back, and Tara's was a form letter up top, basically saying, thanks for your interest, we don't have a position right now. But then she wrote a handwritten note at the bottom that said, Lindsay, the women's game needs young people like you to get into coaching, stick with it, let me know if I can help. And you fast forward, you know, something like 8 or 9 years later, and I'm coaching against her. So it was pretty surreal.
At the Portland Regional, I brought my daughters. I have three daughters. I brought them to see the games. And my youngest fell in love with Juju. You get a chance to coach her. It's all she could talk about on the way home the next day. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. But, you know, what has that been like, the recruitment of Juju Watkins and watching her development and seeing where she is in the game today?
The story that you just told me, I mean, multiply that by 50, 60 times, that's what happened at the Final Four when I'm in Cleveland, people stopping me saying, you know, Juju's my favorite player, love the way she plays, love the type of person she is. I mean, she's magnetic. You know, I knew in taking this job and recruiting Juju that it could be program changing, that it could be trajectory changing, but none of us, I think, foresaw the impact that she's had. First and foremost, you know, she came in with all this hype, and she is a basketball player and a competitor and a winner who also gets attention, not a social media star who hoops on the side. So I think it's really cool that she's just such a student of her craft. You know, she dove across the line in our first, you know, workout session to make her time. And with someone that kind of talent, certainly, you know, it wouldn't be shocking if she cut a corner. She never cuts a corner, you know, and so to see the way that she handled this year, the impact that she had on a program, on a university, on a city, on a community is really neat. And coaching her is something that I'm really grateful for. I take it as a tremendous opportunity. I think we need to partner together and do everything that we can to uplift her and allow her to be, you know, the person she can be in women's basketball, but also use that to help our university and the community as well.
So how do you guys go about getting her ready for next season as potentially the face of the sport, right?
Yeah.
Is that something you're already starting to work on?
For sure. I mean, so you're talking about things, all the things that aren't X's and O's, right? And
yep,
all the things
yep.
that aren't, you know, physical. A lot of this year was kind of learn on the fly. I mean, USC put great resources around me, around her, around us, and still nobody knew exactly what was coming. So I think now we have somewhat of a blueprint. To be honest, I'm going to spend a lot of time this offseason really reaching out. I mean, I think it's important to have a conversation with Lisa Bluter, you know, and because Iowa, I think, is the only person team who's maybe experienced anything like it. I've already had conversations with the Big Ten, Internally here at USC, I already was whiteboarding yesterday with Jen Cohen and JCAP, who's my sports supervisor, on not just Juju, but the things that are coming, like marketing and how we get ready and strategizing around scheduling. Like, we obviously want to both leverage the opportunities that we have and also continue to make sure Juju is in the best possible situation to succeed and to thrive and to be happy, right? So everything from security to, you know, opportunities, you know, for her and for us, we try to be forward thinking and get ahead of as much as we can.
Is your NBA experience, you know, seeing that the spotlight on those guys help you navigate this?
1,000%. I mean, 1,000%. It's like, again, none of us have experienced this directly, but your experiences are informed by what you've known before. So the first thing is, I think, being in the NBA and just the spacing on the floor, how you try to utilize, you know, a star with that kind of talent, how you understand that one player alone obviously doesn't win anything. I mean, I think her great this year was that we were a one seed and got to the Elite Eight. That's why I think it was the best freshman season ever. Her stats are incredible, but who's had that kind of impact on winning right away?
Right.
I think that's what, so you see some of that in the NBA, like there's so much talent, but what impacts winning? But also, yes, I mean, this idea that these guys in the NBA are making millions of dollars, they have things pulled upon them off the court, but it can't impact the integrity of your locker room in terms of you can be very aware of people's individual goals or their brands, but the successful teams are ones that kind of integrate that or keep it alongside the value on good culture, good chemistry, and winning. I also, you know, saw things operate at the highest level in terms of how you, that league does a great job of promoting stars and being it fan friendly, but also, you know, taking care of individuals. So yeah, there's a lot I learned from watching coaches manage that, but also just watching front office and behind the scenes people manage that as well.
18 million viewers on that championship game. And then you look at the ratings for the tournament in general and the fans that were at the Pac-12 tournament. And I'm just curious in your mind, like, you know, it feels sudden to some people, but you're in it. Is there a tipping point on how we arrived here? Is there a slower growth that most aren't seeing that you're seeing from within the game?
I mean, I think the talent, there's been talent for quite some time. I mean, Brianna Stewart is generational in a way too. You know, if she's like a Kevin Durant, right? Who's different than a Michael Jordan, who's different than a Steph Curry, but no less impactful, right? Diana Taurasi was unbelievable. There's been star power before. Very clearly, the difference is platforms, eyeballs. Just 5 years ago, I think 6 years ago, not every NCAA tournament game was on TV. There was a whip around coverage. Like, you might get 3 minutes of this game, 3 minutes of that game, and then, you know, your local team or the UConn game where they were up by 50, right? Like, this year, the games on ABC, shockingly, make a huge difference, right? Full games being on ESPN in primetime slots make a huge difference. So I think there's no other single most important thing than putting the games on TV when and where people can watch them. Then you juxtapose that with this incredible star power. So I'm not saying the star power didn't exist before, but Caitlin Clark is unique and relatable in a way that Steph Curry is, right? Like, logo threes. It's not a dunk. Anyone thinks they can, you know, come down the court in the park and at least try and attempt a 30-foot three. It doesn't always go in, but if they see that, it's exciting. It resonates with them, you know. Then you have these young stars like Juju, who just is electrifying in her right, and Hannah Hidalgo and Paige. Like, I do think it's the right kind of sequence of events, but for sure, women's basketball has been exciting for several years. It just hasn't been on TV this much.
And so what, Charlie Baker comes to you, NCAA says, all right, Lindsay, what should we do next? How do we build on what we have right now?
I mean, they only let us use the March Madness logo like 2 years ago, right? So it's not, we can't stop going units, monetize, right? Like, it's been pretty clear that women's basketball isn't just a value proposition anymore. There's ability to make money. So that's, you know, what drives this thing. So give programs who win games in the NCAA and go far units, because that'll entice administrations to invest in it, because there's a chance to get money back. Continue to think about ways to be forward thinking and grow the women's game relative to coverage. I think they did an incredible job with coverage this year, but again, there's like you know, are we focusing only on one person? Are we focusing on the best teams? Are we focusing on the storylines? I mean, the number of people who stop you and say, and it's not a comparison to men's basketball, but the narratives are more enticing in women's basketball. There's a lot going on. They can't get enough of it. So continue to lean into that and tell the stories, you know, put dollars behind it, raise the level, raise the bar, because we keep meeting those, you know, that bar as it comes. But I think that the units is the next biggest thing.
It seems too, like, you know, on the women's side, the athletes are very identifiable with their schools. The men's side, not only you got the NBA thing, but the transfer portal is so out of control on the men's side that it seems like, you know, fans can relate to players at their school much better on the women's side.
I think so. I mean, the transfer portal is a real thing in our sport too, but without the one and dones, you know, you get attached to players. You see the growth. I think, you know, there's something to the fact that South Carolina lost, you know, to Caitlin Clark and Iowa in the Final Four, and then they play them again in the national championship game. Like, people want, you know, to see those stories grow. I think the women's game is at a point where we probably have the most of those kind of storylines. I think, you know, growing, like, players are very accessible. People, you know, enjoy getting to know the personal stories. There's a brand connection. There's a human connection.
Yep.
So all of those things, I think, you know, you're 100% right.
The women's Final Four will come to Portland in 2030. People here jazzed about it, but there's been some talk about combining the men's and women's events. Where do you stand on that?
You know, I'm always open to whatever I think could be, like, I'm a huge, obviously, men's basketball fan too, like, whatever can grow the game. But I don't know, Cleveland was phenomenal this year. It was popping. It was sustainable. I don't know that combining the men's and the women's Final Four makes sense. I mean, there's two different arena types, right? Like, there's a different feel to it. I'm not sure what value that brings to women's basketball. I think the coverage that we're getting is a lot, could always be more, but I don't think you're splitting, you know, I don't think you're losing coverage because it's on at a different spot. I don't, someone would have to convince me of what that would bring.
How about the regionals? Would you keep the regional the way it was this year?
So, interestingly, right? Like, I see both sides of it. I think the idea is that, you know, if people say, okay, there's a West regional and East regional, you know, way in advance where they're going to be, you know, you can just book your tickets because you know you're going to see eight great teams and build excitement around it. The thing that was slightly difficult as a participant is, like, on the day before our game, when we have open media and open practice, the times were a little wonky because there were other games to play. So I think we got to Portland and our media availability was at like 8 a.m. And Baylor was practicing at 8 a.m. Then we practiced at 9. It was like our schedule was a little off because the teams that were playing games that day had to shoot around.
Yep.
So there were some scheduling things that were a little interesting. But I do think there's some positives in that, you know, our crowds were phenomenal for both games. I think we traveled well. I think the USC fans really showed out, but, I think, you know, UConn against USC on that Monday night was great.
Yeah.
I don't know if those were holdover fans from the other regional. I don't know if people just in Portland turned up. So I think there's some positive things in terms of getting a buzz around two different sites, but I do think there's also some logistical things that maybe make four sites a little bit easier logistically. So I could see both sides of that one.
You guys are off to the Big Ten next year. Your thoughts on the Pac-12 and maybe some of the nostalgia of the conference breaking up and 108 years of history. What were your feelings as that was all going down?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the first shoe that dropped was us in UCLA. You know, I found out 15 minutes before you probably reported it. You were like the first to report it, I think, you know. But I only knew 15 minutes before. So none of us had time to really sit with it. We were just like, oh my goodness. And so for us, before the conference like dissolved, for me, it was a little bit of shock. And then there was some excitement around the opportunities in the Big Ten. And I mean, that's just how I'm wired. Like, change is going to happen. I knew coming back to college athletics, there would be a lot of change. And I wanted to be at a school. I certainly didn't predict that, but wanted to be at a school that was going to be at the forefront of change. And I felt like, okay, this is what's happening. Like, let's ride with it. I think I felt more sadness and more just kind of Sadness is the right word. When that day that the conference dissolved and they couldn't hold it together, and then you read the stories about how close it was and how kind of silly, like they were just almost right there, like that. You know, that was a little bit hard. I would say that the nostalgia for me isn't as much the 108 years, just because I mean I'm a historian and I think it's a great conference. But for me, from a women's basketball standpoint, you know, when we entered the conference, people would have said that was probably the weakest on paper of the Power Five conferences for women's basketball. My first year at Cal, we finished second in the league and got an 8 seed. Now, if you finish second in this league, you are a national championship contender. You know, the next year we finished tied for first and we were a 2 seed and Stanford was 1. So to sort of see how the conference really grew, I know anyone who would tell you that being in those rooms, it was special. Our bonds with the coaches, figuring out how to get good as a group, not just good individual, was part of our conversations. I thought, you know, Mike Nabors on his scheduling thing and Tara and Charlie Turner Thorne and me and Corey, like we really like had conversations about how to grow it. And then to see that go from being considered the weakest Power Five to the strongest year in and year out was something we're all really proud of. Now, I sort of felt as that was going on, I started to look around and go, guys, men's basketball and football, like it's not going that well. Like this, the Pac-12 network has been good for us, but we need to kind of what's going on here. And that's when you kind of felt like, okay, is this sustainable? And so I started to get a little nervous about that. And then, you know, obviously things went the way they did, but I have nothing but gratitude for the coaches I got to work with for these incredible schools. And I tell people all the time, our final 4 year in 2013, the thing I'm most proud of is going 17-1 in that conference, because it's phenomenal coaches, phenomenal talent, and winning a conference championship is about as hard as it gets.
So for the next, what do you got, 7 months till the season starts? Will your next 7 months be the same going into the Big Ten as they would have been if you were going to be in the Pac-12 next year? Or do you have to adjust anything?
I think I've got to try to do an early dive on like scouts, right?
Yeah.
Like, I haven't in the past in the summer gone and watched from a scouting standpoint, Arizona State and Stanford and Oregon State, because we know them all. You know, I'm not saying they don't change things, but you know, you do whatever you do in the summer, X's and O's wise, thinking forward. But I do think part of my X's and O training or whatever I do this summer is going to include a little bit of trying to learn some of these teams, so that when we get to the conference, I mean, every single team except UCLA, we will only play once. So you don't get a second shot at it. So I don't want it to feel like a non-conference game. I want to feel like there's some type of, you know, and those schools all have to learn 2 new schools. We have to learn 17 yep. schools or whatever. And so I'll do some deep dives on that, which will probably help me with other stuff. So that's different. In terms of recruiting and the other stuff I do with our own team, that's kind of the same. You know, I tell people we're still going to have the same number of home games. We still live in LA. We still are playing in Galen Center. We're going to figure out the travel. Like I'm not as concerned about that. I'm really excited about being, you know, on these big games, on big stages in different parts of the country. I'm excited about a lot of that and the newness that'll come with that.
Could you explain why you're not that concerned about the travel? Cause I think, and I haven't seen the master schedule from the Big Ten, but I'm thinking you got to go to Minneapolis 1 week and you got to go to Bloomington the next week. And that's going to be brutal. But to the extent that you can divulge the basics, how are you looking at that?
So we're never going to go to Minneapolis 1 week and Bloomington the next week.
Oh, okay.
We're going to go to, I don't know, Iowa and Nebraska 1 weekend and then be home.
Okay.
Next weekend, just like we were in the Pac-12. Now the trip, you know, Iowa and Nebraska is further than Cal and Stanford, right? But you know, Utah and Colorado was not the closest trip, and Washington State is not the closest trip. So flight times will be longer. This is my understanding. We're going to take 4 trips, 2 games, which is just like we did in the Pac-12. I think there'll be an extra day in between because they play on either the Big Ten plays, I think, Wednesday, Saturday, or Thursday, mm-hmm. Sunday. So it'll be a bit of a longer trip with a day in between. You know, there'll be some time zone changes, but the cadence of it will feel similar, I think. You know, the thing I've talked to our administration the most about is what the plane rides feel like. And this is where my MBA experience helps a little bit. We were on planes a lot, you know,
yep.
they have to be able to either study or sleep on the planes. But I'll tell you, players, travel bothers them less than you would think. They knock out on that plane, or they could get something done. And so I think that we're going to do everything we can to, you know, nutritionists and hydration and when are we arriving and how, but I just think it's just a little bit longer on the flights and the rest of the cadence will remain the same. And, you know, some of it is just an optimistic mindset. Like it's four trips, like, you know, you got to just be ready to do it and figure it out and take the benefits where they come and figure out the things that are more challenging.
When you were for your NBA flights, were peanut butter and jelly sandwiches all the rage with the players?
There was a lot of food in every single capacity of everything. I don't particularly remember. I mean, there was so many food options. Maybe some players ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, definitely before the games. That was part of the spread, but we ate well on the planes for sure.
I'm interested in the portal and how maybe that has changed the way coaches coach kids. Can you yell at a kid? Do kids appreciate that if they know if you're coming from a good place? How does the portal affect kind of how you do the teaching part?
I mean, the portal doesn't affect how I do that. I'm not much of a screamer anyway. I think the portal impacts players' freedom and autonomy, right? So, you know, communication and treatment of people, I think, has always been paramount, but now there is, if they don't like something or they're not comfortable with something, they have freedom to go. I think an awareness of what players need from you is always important. None of us are perfect at it. You know, we can all grow in various ways, but I think the number one thing is trying to find, like, what is a player looking for and can you provide that? And if you can, great. Doesn't mean everything's always perfect, but if you can't, at least there's, you know, opportunity to say, okay, you may not get this here. Do you want to go elsewhere then? Cause I don't, you know, you don't want people who aren't happy or aren't 2 feet in, or you might not get everything you want here and you could go, but at the same time, that won't provide everything you want. So it kind of forces, I think, good, honest conversation, puts you in a situation where you have to be, able to continually kind of pour into people, and also challenges players to say, what do you want? And are your goals and stuff realistic? So it's a lot. I mean, it definitely feels like free agency to some degree. I think you just encourage people to figure out what their priorities are and, you know, figure it out. It doesn't change kind of like who we are in terms of, you know, I'm not going to walk in and say, you know, you're out, you're in. Like, you still want to have those relationships and say, okay, what, you know, where are we going with this? But it's a lot. It's really different than before. I think it's a different job description and we're all trying to figure it out on the fly, but it's like, if you always secretly wanted to be a GM, now you are a GM.
How do you see, let's say 3 years, athletes are employees and they collectively bargain and it's very professional. How do you see the women's game in that environment? Do things need to happen to make sure the women's game can thrive in an employee, athlete-employee situation?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, that's really hard to, like, map out in my head because we have no real blueprint for it.
Yeah.
I do think 3 years from now, we could see schools paying players directly versus collectives paying players. Like, I'm not an expert in it, but, like, don't you think that's going to happen? I mean, I don't know that this model is sustainable. So if the schools are paying athletes directly, this is my philosophy usually in all the rules that come in college sports, and, like, whatever they say it's going to look like, then we try to figure out how to best navigate that within that. We want to be at the forefront. We want to be treating student athletes the best. Like, I think they should have been paid or be able to monetize the whole time. I do think they should have autonomy the whole time. So I'm not, you know, fighting this new change going, let's go back to how it was 30 years ago. I just want to be at the forefront of doing it well and with integrity. So if players are paid by the university instead of the collective, okay, how does that look? That's where now you talk about Title IX and fairness amongst men and women. Like, it brings some ability to to navigate that with a fairness standpoint from a federal level. The collectively bargaining, like, and the employee thing, I haven't heard too many athletes in any realm say they want to be employees in that sense, because then there are the things that come with that, right? Like the employees being able to be hired and fired, or being able to, you know, I don't know, have restrictions on them that employees have. Like, I don't know that they want that. I think they want to be student athletes, but that who are compensated for their name, image, and likeness, or the ability to monetize. And I think for women, if you put fair structures in place, we got to keep investing in the game and making sure that all of this stuff is great, but that we keep kind of the integrity of what makes, you know, our game exciting. And that's mainly the people in it. And I think the personalities, and hopefully we can keep growing the game and keep that going.
Would it be simpler if football were separated out from everything else?
Sounds like it, probably.
Yeah.
I love our football program. Like, it's been nothing but an asset for us to be at a school that values football and is great. I mean, Caleb Williams is at our game and I'm tight with him. Some of the football staff has been some of my closest people. The administration here have been like women's basketball, football. Like, I don't feel second fiddle. I mean, I know I know the money around that, but for me, it's been a positive thing. But from an entity standpoint, in terms of what's driving all this conference realignment and, you know, what's driving the TV stuff, like maybe football having its own playoff thing and its own entity and could ultimately be, you know, a positive step for everybody.
You know, we ask our guests about the influences they have in their life and maybe the advice they've got over the years. As I say that, the best advice that you've received, or maybe advice you find yourself leaning on in tough times, what do you think about?
I mean, big picture, certainly, I think my parents and like the way I was raised, like my father did a lot of interesting things in his political career. And I remember both my parents have passed away, but I remember when I was a kid, or I was kind of getting close to like life decisions. And I was like, how did you know that you wanted to do this and then this and then this? And you did. And he's like, you're so type A. Like, I wasn't even worried about it. He's like, I always did the thing that felt like the right thing at the right time. And my father led a group to the March on Washington. He was at the I Have a Dream speech. Like, I'm saying cool things, I mean, way cooler than what I've done. But this idea that like when he knew when to go be in politics or leave politics to have his own law practice so he could come to my games, you know, like I just felt like he was so informed by the right things, like what feels right at the time. And that's been really useful in my career of, you know, when does it feel like the right time to make a move? Or if I have this opportunity in the NBA and it's really scary to leave what I'm doing and what I love, but maybe for something that's bigger and better than I ever dreamed. So I like that kind of informs my decision-making. I think the way I was raised in that sense more than anything else. I would say that's a big one. When I was deciding whether or not to take the USC job, I had a lot of good heart-to-hearts with JB Bickerstaff, who's the head coach of the Cavs. And I struggled with like, but am I letting people down if I leave the NBA? And is it unfinished business? And he was the one who was really like, Lindsay, as coaches, we're all just searching for like this ability to lead a team and influence people and do the things that we love doing. And it doesn't matter if it's the Cavs or USC or here. Like, and I remember, you know, those words were kind of like, yeah, like I could be anywhere and have that influence. It doesn't have to be the end. And so that, I think those are the two things that jumped to my mind first, although I've had great mentors, obviously, and a lot of people advocating for me in my life and career that I could talk about. But those are two things that jump out first.
You know, I mentioned the three daughters, and I'm fascinated by this dynamic. And I've talked to a lot of coaches, especially women's basketball coaches, about building confidence in young girls and what you're looking for when you recruit. And I had one coach in the Pac-12 tell me, they look for a kid who's got an older sibling. They know that that kid can rebound. But give me an idea, parenting advice for a dad who's got three daughters. When I talk about confidence, what comes to mind? Because your parents did something with you, Lindsay, that it was a gift they gave you. You know, what did they do?
First of all, like, let them gravitate towards whatever they want to gravitate towards and have fun with it. You know, I've said I come from a family of lawyers, there was never one time I felt a pressure than to do anything other than what I loved doing. I majored in political science, but I didn't want to go to law school. I wanted to coach basketball. When I say not once, it's like, well, are you sure you want to do that? Maybe for a year and then go to law. I mean, literally, they allowed me to follow my passions, because if it's anyone else's passion, it's not going to work. In terms of the sports, I played everything. They let me play things where I wasn't the best, you know, like freshman year, I wanted to try lacrosse. I ended up making the varsity lacrosse team, but I was not I was like, I struggled because it wasn't basketball that I played my whole life. So letting your kids play a number of different sports and really enjoying it, confidence, teaching them that confidence can't come from somebody else. Like, you earn confidence with doing the work and doing the reps, and confidence should be internal and not external. And confidence doesn't have to be perfection. I think women are told so often, like, don't try that if you're not sure you're going to be perfect. Don't apply for that job unless you think you're the best one. Like, don't put your foot out to the next thing if maybe there's someone better. Like, no, like, try it, step out, feel like you're capable and worthy, even if you're not perfect. I think women are often held back by this notion of perfection. Nobody's perfect at anything. But mainly with sports, I would say, let them play multiple sports, let them try and let them decide what their passion is versus, someone imparting that upon them.
That's great advice. You got that?
Yeah,
you got that, John?
I got it. Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys
for doing this. Fantastic insight. And USC, the state of the women's game. I mean, the timing, and we got lucky with the timing with Tara's news last night. But thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both for the work that you do. It's been great. And anything you need from me, just let me know.
Parents, did you get that?
Yeah.
Take notes. I thought she was fantastic. Everything from Juju to Tara to parenting and her own story and just a lot.
Yeah, that's my reaction. Is she gave advice for lots of different people, parents and coaches and fans and college administrators. There was some good insight there for the NCAA, you know, on the state of the women's game. It was she covered a ton of ground and did it all very, very insightfully.
Yeah, I'm really I'm fascinated by, you know, the teams in the Pac-12 as we knew it going their different directions and what their journeys are going to be like. And, you know, as she talked about the airline trips and kids, I could see her players on the plane, right? You know, as she was describing sort of that, and she's been through that in the NBA, just really, really rich stuff, valuable stuff. She's obviously in a great position with Juju Watkins. And I thought her comment about reaching out to the Iowa coach to talk about the year that Caitlin Clark had and how they managed it was really, really smart. Just really good stuff.
Yeah. And if she even gave us a tiny morsel of news, the Big Ten's basketball schedules, men's and women's, the Olympics, how they're going to manage the Olympic sports with the West Coast schools. We haven't seen that. They're still working on it, but now we know, you know, it's basically going to mirror the Pac-12s. You're going to go, you know, every other weekend, you're going to be going to play two games, and it's going to be, clearly it's going to be Bloomington and West Lafayette 1 week, and 2 weeks later, you're going to Minneapolis and Madison. So we got a little bit of insight into how that's going to work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I've covered the Big Ten before, and some of those, we tend to on the West Coast, think about those cities all in one place. You know, I drove between Bloomington and West Lafayette, and that's a stretch, right? But still, if you're making that trip on a weekend, it gives you time between those two games to get to those two places. I'll still be curious to see how that all works out and what are the cities that they pair together. And then the other thing is I kind of enjoyed in the pack schedule seeing these teams play each other multiple times and get a second crack. And how did they adjust to that second game? We're not going to have that in all cases in the Big Ten. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yep. She was terrific on so many topics, right? Including the stuff about some of the challenges with the way they had set the regionals up this year.
Yeah. And I was at that Portland regional. It was weird to be like at a game day, have a practice going on before the game and have a news conference going on while, you know, a team is getting ready to go out onto the court to play a game. And it, you know, I think that they will strongly consider going to four sites in the women's regional. But, you know, I know that the BID group in Portland is excited about that because they feel like, you know, the bids for 27 and 28 just went out for the regionals. In Portland, I asked, I said, did you see cities that were bigger because of the Caitlin Clark effect? Did you see cities that were larger? Did you see Dallas and Chicago? And, you know, did you see other cities that you don't typically see when you're competing for those regionals? And they said, no, it was the same suspects. And so Portland and some of those cities of that size that have traditionally got it, like Tampa, Portland, Columbus, Ohio, they'll all continue to bid. And I think they're thinking, hey, there might be four bids out there for a regional instead of two, which could benefit some of those cities. But really good stuff from
terrific
from Coach. Yep.
Terrific conversation, you know, and such a hot topic right now. And it was really it was great that she was able to join us, and it was on fairly short notice. So thanks very much to Lindsay and to folks at USC for making this work.
If you have an idea of who you'd like to see us interview next, tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT, or tweet at John Wilner, at Wilner Hotline. If you want to read me, johncanzano.com, get a free subscription or a paid subscription. What works for you works for me, always. Or read John Wilner at Pac-12Hotline.com. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Appreciate everybody who subscribes.
Thanks so much.